someone thinks of me. In this scenario, I am the color orange. People have a right to like and dislike whatever they want. Trying not to change people's minds is also about learning to trust boundaries. I was talking to my dad the other day. My dad is one of those people, perhaps you have them in your family, who was always angry at a handful of people. Instead of trying to defend these targets from his, to my mind, irrational ire, I attempted to let him vent and to not change his opinion, because in the end, what does it really hurt that an old man somewhere is angry at someone who will never find out? Why must I correct my dad? Why is it so important that he feels about people in the world exactly how I feel about them and it? And who is it helping when I try to make him see things my way? If I can really pull this off, really stop trying to change people's minds, I predict it will free up a lot of mental energy to remember people's names. What I wish they told me about planning a wedding. The illustration for this one is a bouquet of flowers. Before planning a wedding, a process I'm in the midst of, I never understood what the big deal was. I never understood why people talked about it like it was one of the big stresses of life, why untold numbers of books had been written about it, why blocks of programming were devoted to it, and why it took people I love and made them unrecognizable. I also never understood the halting, wide-eyed warnings people would issue when I told them I was planning a wedding. "Whatever you do," they would say, grabbing my wrist for emphasis, "don't read the bridal magazines. They will just drive you crazy. Read two, but then stop." Or, "don't listen to all the voices. Just remember, it's about what you and Daniel want." I also received the exact opposite advice, people saying, "the sooner you recognize that a wedding is for your family and really isn't for you and Daniel, the easier it'll be." The intensity and variety of the advice I received made me think I wasn't taking the whole endeavor seriously enough. Not that I wasn't taking matrimony seriously, because I was, but that somehow I wasn't taking wedding planning seriously enough. For example, I hadn't signed up for ballroom dancing classes, started a scrapbook, or even made a profile on Pinterest. And when people discovered this, and that I was trying to plan the thing in about 4 months, they gave me a look that was a mix of pity, fear, and vicarious thrill. Probably the same look I would get if they found out I was going on a lengthy polar expedition and all I brought to sustain me was a cardigan, half a Fresca, and a peanut. But what could possibly take so long, I wondered. Why do people start planning 14 months in advance? Now I know, having almost come out the other side of it, and here's what I wish people had explained to me. If you are the kind of person who looks at two vendors online and then chooses one and is happy with that decision and never looks back, you don't need an impossibly long lead time. However, the planning process takes a long time if you're a relatively thorough person who likes to make sure each decision is the best one given a number of factors, from quality of service to cost. I'm indecisive and I like to weigh my options. To feel comfortable, I like to thoroughly vet each detail, something I should have known about myself to begin with, but didn't quite recognize, and so I'm finding the process to be immensely stressful and time-consuming. Another thing no one really warned me about, the paralyzing effect of, quote, "it's your day." You will receive this message saying that your wedding is your big day and you should love every aspect of it between 2 and 3 million times in the course of planning a wedding. You will think it isn't really affecting you, but then you will sit down and try to choose between two florists. One uses peonies, and you aren't sure whether you like peonies. And on the one hand, does it really matter? A flower is a flower. But on the other hand, it's your big day, and you should love everything about it, which is a lot of pressure. At a certain point, you will wonder why you're doing this. It's stressful and expensive, and you will think you should just elope or postpone the wedding or just not get married at all. And you will freak out. And then you will discover the parallel universe of wedding websites and books devoted to this reaction. I don't know if it's a generational thing or just something that has always happened but wasn't often talked about, but women getting cold feet isn't that uncommon, especially women who get married in their 30s and are used to being independent and fear the loss of that identity. At the outset, I thought of planning a wedding as akin to planning a party, something I don't have a lot of experience doing, but how hard can it be? Now I realize it's about coming to terms with what it means to be married and figuring out whether you like peonies. I still don't love them. I did really like our wedding florist. However, I told her that I don't like peonies, and so she didn't use them. She used some other flower that looks almost exactly like a peony. Can you believe it? I'm actually very glad to have moved on from that segment of my life because planning a wedding makes you care way too much about things that really don't matter, but begin to feel like they matter a ton. I'm Not Moody and Other Lies. The illustration is a roller coaster that spells out Allison. I'm beginning to worry that I've been lying to myself for years about my fundamental nature. I don't mean in the big ways. It's not as if I used to think I am a writer named Allison who owns a puppy and is about to get married, but recently discovered that deep down I'm a retired black man named Fred who lives for recreational chess. But in terms of the nuances of personality, I'm no longer sure. For example, I don't think of myself as a moody person. I think of myself as a good-natured, even-keeled person who's been in a bad mood on and off for the last 30-something years. I was puzzling over this recently, about the fact that for someone who doesn't consider herself moody, I sure am moody. And then I began to wonder why it is I cling to this notion when most evidence is to the contrary. I think it's that in college, which apparently is the last time I revisited myself, I wasn't moody. For whatever reason, college really was 4 great, enlightening, fulfilling, and enriching years. Everything else has been a little less thrilling, a fact I kind of hate to acknowledge. I don't want to be that person for whom college was the best 4 years, though I'd rather be that person than the one for whom high school was the best 4 years. That person was a cheerleader. The problem with those school was the best people is that they peaked years ago. I want to peak shortly before I die, or perhaps live in a sustained state of peaking. I just don't want the best to be behind me. Let me ask you this. Do non-moody people sometimes feel like crying for no reason at all? Do non-moody people wake up and think, I just have to get through the day and then I can go back to sleep? Do non-moody people only answer their phone 0.5% of the time? I realize what I'm describing sounds like low-level depression, which probably goes hand in hand with moodiness and hence doesn't apply to me. And then I was thinking about the other ways in which I might not be who I say I am. For instance, I hardly ever listen to my favorite band. If someone were to ask me who my favorite bands are, I would have to reach far back into the memory reserves, as the first thing to go with age is the ability to keep up with current music. But the name I always throw out there, Sunny Day Real Estate, is a defunct group I hardly ever listen to because the music is too beautiful and too poignant, the same reasons why I love it and why I can't listen to it. So should it really be my go-to favorite? In the same way that unromantic people say you marry the person you're dating at the time you're ready to get married, that it's more about timing than anything else, your favorite band is probably the band you're listening to at the age it's important to declare a favorite. And don't even get me started on favorite movies. At one point in grade school, I used to consider Ruthless People and Big Business to be my favorites. This is what I think. There's who you want to be, who you are, and who you let yourself become. I want to be a stylish skirt and dress person, but I'm actually a bootcut jeans person who lets herself be a sweatpants person at home. But I'm not moody. But I actually am moody. That was an aside. The actual text ends it, but I'm not moody. I'm just telling you guys. Just Me or Everyone, the illustration is my podcast logo. On my podcast, Allison Rosen is Your New Best Friend, I do a segment called Just Me or Everyone, during which people write in and tell me things they think or do that make them wonder if it's just them. The idea for the segment came when I was out walking one day in Brooklyn, where I lived at the time, and a fire truck tore down the street, engine blaring. I wonder if it's headed to my apartment, I thought, imagining my house in flames because I'd left my straightening iron on. Okay, remember my note about straightening irons from many, many lifetimes ago? I guess take back what I said. It was a familiar thought, the same one I had every time I was out walking and heard a fire engine siren. Then I wondered whether I was the only one who had this thought. I'm not, but it's less common than I would have expected. I've been doing this segment for a few years now, previously on a live-streaming internet talk show I did from my living room in Brooklyn, and now on my twice-weekly audio podcast, which is very, very entertaining and enlightening, I might add. So if you're not already listening, might I recommend you rectify that? iTunes.com/AllisonRosen or AllisonRosen.com. And as such, I have a pretty good sense of the idiosyncratic thoughts and habits we all share. I thought I'd reveal some recent submissions. People tweet them to me at ARIYNBF, my show's Twitter handle, along with my comments, lest you also do these things and think you're the only one. At Abe Lopez. I get super nervous and tongue-tied when I call someone expecting a voicemail and they answer. Yes. Sadly, I tend to prefer avoiding the phone altogether these days, but when I'm reveling in the comfort of thinking I won't have to connect with another human being, and then suddenly I'm confronted with a live one, it's scary. Side note, how sad that it's come to this. At Larry Osberger says, is it just me or does everyone stare at the rug when they're on the toilet and cross their eyes a little until they see little faces in the pile? I stare at floor tiles. Only some kind of maniac would have carpet in his or her bathroom, unless you're referring to a bath rug. In that case, I get what you're saying, but I recommend the dimples in the tiles. Better for shapes, but still not as good as asbestos-filled cottage cheese ceilings. I've recently heard someone refer to that as popcorn ceilings, which is weird because, no, it's cottage cheese ceilings. At Mike Chemernick says, if someone mispronounces my name and asks if that's how you say it, I say, you got it. I definitely don't do this. Maybe I should. Because I get Rosin, and I say Rosen. Because that is how you pronounce it. But maybe I should just let it fly. I don't know. At Thomas Shod says, I feel like a dish you hand scrub with tons of soap and hot water is not as clean as one that is just stuck in washer and probably gets a squirt of water. Yes, I thought this was just me, but I have a hang-up about dishes that are hand-washed. I'm convinced I can taste the soap. No amount of water is enough to rinse it off. I do have a thing. I don't trust hand-washing. At Higher Bassist says, when someone doesn't respond to a text message in a timely manner, I begin to worry about their well-being. Yes, or I begin to worry they're mad at me, and yet I take my sweet time responding to people. I am a jerk. At Keenan Dion says, I love the warm, cozy feeling of a gas station on a dark, stormy morning. I love dark, stormy mornings, but I would heartily describe gas stations as warm and cozy. In my experience, they're usually cold and smelly. At Thompson A. 2006 says, whenever I hear 100% money-back guarantee, I wonder if the company sends the returned item out to the next customer. Well, I never worried about this before, but now I will. So, thanks. Actually, just yesterday, I was thinking about this because my husband received something that was clearly used. And I was thinking, when I return something, is that thing generally being resold to the public? But I don't have an answer. I just have the questions, you guys. Goodbye, fruit salad. The illustration is a face made out of, I think that's a cantaloupe. The eyes are strawberries. The nose is a grape. The mouth is blueberries. And then there's an X below it made out of bananas. I've never been a particularly coordinated person. I frequently find myself banging my arm or shoulder on door frames I've passed through hundreds of times, tripping over familiar coffee tables, dribbling soda down my shirt, and trying to close the trunk of my car and walking away only to hear it pop open. But I usually manage to get through my day without significant incident. Then yesterday happened. I was in Las Vegas to perform a show at Treasure Island. Adam Carolla and I flew in with just enough time for him to go to his signing and for me to go to my room, put on makeup, and change clothes before the show. On a day when I'm performing, I'll drink coffee up until the time I go on. Except for a recent show in Chicago, during which I had to leave the stage to pee, an ordeal that still haunts me because the feeling I experienced before exiting the stage was one of such extreme discomfort I couldn't focus on anything else, it always works out fine. That is, except for the part where I can't get to sleep that night, and I chalk it up to not sleeping well in hotels as opposed to the 14 cups of coffee I drank earlier. But a ritual is a ritual. So after arriving in Vegas, checking in, and doing this thing I do when I first get to a hotel room, where I pace around in tight circles trying to figure out what to do first, unzip my suitcase, hang up my coat, check my email, charge my phone, turn on the TV, open the curtains, close the curtains. By the way, it's been a little while since I've been in a hotel, because we haven't really traveled since I had the baby. And I know that there are all sorts of people who are like, the first year is the best time to travel because it gets more complicated after that. And I'm sure you're right, but I just have not felt the inclination to put on the whole production that would be trying to travel with a baby. But anyway, I had forgotten that this is what I do in hotels. That tight circle, what to do with myself, pacing thing. I don't miss it. Uh-oh, my aside was so long that now I must go back to the sentence before to make this make sense. For you, the listener, whom I am so happy you're listening, thank you. Okay, let's just go back a little bit. So after arriving in Vegas, checking in and doing this thing I do when I first get to a hotel room, where I pace around in tight circles trying to figure out what to do first, I began to get ready. This involves a lot of walking back and forth between the bathroom where I'm putting on makeup and the bedroom where my suitcase is. At one point, when my makeup was on enough for me to begin drinking coffee, I waltzed out of the bathroom, tripped over the carpet, ricocheted off the dresser, bounced off the bed, and landed dazed near the desk. Next, I tried to pour some milk from a glass into the coffee. Why is it impossible to do this move without spilling everywhere? You never appreciate the pour spout until you're trying to pour milk into your coffee from a glass and it goes everywhere. It would have been easier if I'd just poured the milk directly into my fist and then thrown it in the direction of the cup. Then I distractedly took a bite of fruit salad, not a regular part of the ritual, I should add, and all hell broke loose. As I chomped down, I somehow managed to snag a bit of cheek between a molar and a grape, and my lower lip between another grape and a tooth, and I drew blood in multiple spots. It was like someone else's teeth were inside my mouth, attacking me. How does this happen? It's not as if it's the first bite of food I've had since I got my adult teeth. Presumably, I've been doing this thing where I put food in my mouth via spoon or fork, chew it up, and then swallow it thousands of times. Why did this one time cause such wanton destruction? Why the multiple grape cheek tooth pileup? I want to blame the grapes. Had they not been there, I don't think this would have happened. But had I not been overly ambitious, thinking I could handle a bite involving more than one grape plus cantaloupe, I probably would have been fine. But does anyone else know that more than one grape equals danger? It's like being trapped in a small closet stuffed with a bunch of balloons and a knife. Sounds like a scene from an awful horror movie that I would never watch. In sum, my mouth still hurts, I can't sleep, and I'll never attempt to eat fruit salad again. I think of this often. This is like the epitome of my own mouth turning on me. Because I find that I will absentmindedly bite down on my lip or my cheek more often than one should. This is not a cool thing to admit. I opt for spoons over forks if I'm eating something that is spoonable, because I would bang the tines into my teeth so many times and my bottom teeth are a little bit chipped. Not like, oh, she was addicted to meth chipped, but if you look closely, the tines took their toll. That's the name of my one-woman show. Anyway, yeah, so I will distractedly mangle myself a lot, but never as bad as the fruit salad incident in Las Vegas. About the book. For my birthday a few years ago, my husband presented me with a hand-bound book of my columns from the first year I was syndicated. At the top of each page was an illustration he'd done, having worked late into the night at his office to keep it a surprise. Daniel told me he made it because he wanted me to know he believed in me and felt I should be published in book form. Okay, so that is what I thought was what he said when he gave it to me, and I appreciated it. Because, of course, I want to put out a book, but I had been published before, so it didn't completely make sense. And then I overheard him on the phone explaining the whole project to someone, and he was saying that he made it for me because he wanted to show me that I had already written a book. And then I thought, uh-oh, I already wrote the about the book, and that is not exactly how I recounted it. So at the very beginning, I mean, at this point, weeks ago, I don't know how long it took you to listen to this whole thing. Months? Hours? And I don't know whether I want it to have felt like a long time or to have just gone by in the blink of an eye. I don't know. Whatever will make it something that you recommend to someone, that one. But anyway, I told the correct version of the story at the beginning, and now I'm going to share the not exactly accurate version that's at the end of the book in my about the book. Now I have to go back a sentence. At least this only started happening just recently. Daniel told me he made it because he wanted me to know he believed in me and felt I should be published in book form. Also, I gave him an over-the-cabinet door organizer as a gift one year, and he wanted me to relive his look of disappointment and confusion every single day for the rest of my life. He didn't say this, but it was implied. The fact that this gift from him to me has now been turned into a real book, one that you can hold in your hands or read on your screen, or listen to, as you are right now, makes me so happy. Below is the original cover he made and the copyright page. The book you're reading is very much the same as the original gift, just printed by a slightly larger press in a slightly larger run. And then below is the cover that he made. And it's a picture of me sitting at the kitchen table in my parents' house with Oliver in my lap, and he's kind of asleep with his head resting on the table. And I have a sort of a smirk on my face. And then to the right of that is the original copyright that was in the book. Copyright 2014 by Allison Rosen. All rights reserved. Printed and bound by her loving husband on the occasion of her birthday, May 11th, 2014. Library of Congress is a place where books are kept, but not this one, yet. Allison Rosen, first edition. 1, American Wit and Humor. 2, Rosen Allison. 3, Beautiful Ladies. Printed in the United States of America. Book design and illustrations by Daniel Quantz. First hardback edition. Acknowledgements. Thank you, Jack Newcomb, for reaching out to me and suggesting I write the column that became this book. Thank you, Alyssa Stevens, for seeing this through and working patiently and diligently around my schedule. Thank you, Simone Sleekhouse, and everyone at Creators for working with me on the column. Thank you, Will Swaim, and everyone at OC Weekly for helping me become a better writer. I miss you all. Thank you to all the other magazines and newspapers I've worked at or been published in. Thank you to my parents for loving and supporting me. Thank you, Diane Meyer. Thank you, Laura, David, Max, Josh, Beth, Emily, Claire, Nick, Cindy, Hennessy, Cody, and Sam. Okay, I just have to say, I really struggled with the acknowledgments. But then I'm like, what if, and I don't want this to be the case or think this will be the case, but what if this is the only book I ever get out there? I really got to get it all in now. I mean, most likely the tines have turned on me, will be published in book form at one point, but I'm just saying, I really, really dug in on this one. Thank you to all my friends in Costa Mesa and New York. In no particular order, thank you Trevor Stockinger, Tom Rapp, Jeff Fox, Jenna Kim Jones, Alan Moss, Greg Heller, Greg Fitzsimmons, The Angoras, Yami Burns, Roya Young, Dustin Goot, Anthony Matero, Shane Dawson, Todd Christopher, Itai Rice, Jana Marin Pietri, Alyssa Rubin, Adam Nettler, Bellamy Blackstone, The Facts of Life, Refresh Sodas, Hillary, Megan Parkansky, Lisa Lowry, Leanne Ward, Rafael Castaneda, Josh Holtzclaw, Jason Dix, Becky McClure, Diane Cross, Elizaveta Ramnarine, Raquel Michelle, Alexis Chen, Ulysses Atkins, Lisa Robles, Jessica Trevino, Diana Dow, Sarah Ellis, Jessica McMichael, Rini Ray, Vanessa Rose, Lisa Nero, Kevin Portillo, Tony Loki, Amanda Dix, Cassie Bedell, Layla C. Rollins-Cohen, Sheila Brown, Britta Harris, Rebecca Cook, Shannon Kenny, Stephanie Plummer, Shannon Stokes, Candace, Mo, Eric Pasquale, all the Patreon supporters and Allison people, Best Friends Fan Cast, and JMO Patrol. Those are podcasts dedicated to my podcast. The listeners and guests of my podcast who make me feel less alone, my friends in the podcast community, Steve Wilson, David and Nina Raphael, Ellen, Elaine, Carrie Wambach, Grace Wakagawa, The Adam Carolla Show, Red Eye, and Today in New York. I know I am forgetting people. Thank you, Daniel, Oliver, Wendy, and Elliot. You are my heart. And finally, this is not in there, but it's implied. Thank you to you, listener of this book. You're my favorite. About the author. Allison Rosen, I know her, is a writer, TV personality, and podcaster best known for her podcast, Allison Rosen is Your New Best Friend, as well as being the former news girl and co-host of The Adam Carolla Show. Allison's roots are in traditional media. She began her career as a professional journalist early, scoring a contributing writer byline for the Los Angeles Times while still in high school. Her work has appeared in Rolling Stone, People, 17, Elle, The New York Post, Vibe, Spin, Maxim, The Village Voice, The Huffington Post, OC Weekly, Time Out New York, Yahoo, and Bon Appetit, among others. Allison has built a loyal following through her blogs, videos, social media, and interactive Ustream show, the precursor to her podcast, for which she was dubbed, quote, the future of television by former AOL CEO Barry Schuller. She has also carved a niche for herself as a pretty, comical, slightly devilish TV personality. Years ago, she played in a band, which she likes to mention because it sounds cool. And she was born in Oakland, which she believes gives her cred, even though she only lived there for 7 months. Allison currently resides in Los Angeles with her husband, baby, and dog. She always gets lost, even though she has GPS. Tropical Attire Encouraged, and Other Phrases That Scare Me, is also available as an ebook for Kindle, Amazon Fire, iPad, Nook, and Android e-readers. Visit creatorspublishing.com to learn more. Creators Publishing. We publish books. We find compelling storytellers and help them craft their narrative, distributing their novels and collections worldwide. Hey, everyone. So I am sitting here with my husband, Daniel Quantz, who did the illustrations for the book and who made the original book by hand that has been turned into this book that you're now listening to. Daniel, hello and welcome.
Hi, sweetheart. Yes, all those things are true. I did make it by hand, but not the one that people would be buying now. I did not make those by hand.
That would have taken you a long time.
Been a lot of work.
Well, how much work was the book that you made?
Oh my God.
I'm going to need to hear that it was a lot, but worth it.
Yeah, it took me months.
Actually, sorry, going to cut you off.
Oh boy.
Can you explain why you wanted to make the book?
So there's probably a couple reasons. I've always been interested in book binding, maybe not always, but like for a while, mm-hmm. You know, the art of book binding is something that it's one of those crafts that I feel is lost. Everything's been automated and, you know, is done by machines now, but there was a time when a lot of care and craft went into making books and,
care and craft went into these.
Yeah. Well, we'll get there.
Okay.
Jeez. And I had written a graphic novel. I was writing another graphic novel at the time and thought that it would be really, I was starting to think, oh, it would be really cool to, have, once it's published, get a bunch of the artists, a bunch of the pages printed out and then hand bind it. And wouldn't that be special to have like a version of the book you could sell that was actually hand bound by the author? So I was, had been in my mind as a thing I wanted to do. And then you were writing this column. And if I may let people have a peek behind the scenes of your mind.
It's a scary place. I feel like actually after listening to this book or reading this book, both hopefully I've made that clear it a number of times. I feel like they probably feel that they have peeked behind the curtain and they're frightened.
I think you were feeling like you wanted to write a novel. You are, I think.
A novel?
Or a book.
Yeah.
Wait. Yeah, probably not a novel.
Well, actually,
not fiction, but
I think that you have often felt like I should write a novel, yeah. Like, and I feel I don't even know where to begin with fiction. I've written fiction a little bit, but in that, general, I just
reached out to you, I was proposing
before we were together.
Yeah, when we first met, I was trying to get you to write a young adult novel, because I think you're a great writer, and so I think you could really do a great job with that. Not a novel for adults, young, but a novel for young adults who don't really know better. I'm just kidding. But you were thinking of, you had a few ideas for like a nonfiction kind of thing, but you were having trouble putting it together, or I don't know. And it dawned on me, that after a year of these columns, you had enough to fill a book. And so I thought it would be really cool for your birthday to put it together in a book and give and show you that while you've been like, you know, agonizing over what to do, in the meantime you've written a book. And I kind of wanted to give it to you as a way to inspire you to feel like this is something that you could accomplish. It also was an opportunity for me to learn how to bookbind. So it kind of served a dual. So anyway,
you guys, that little laugh that you heard was because I think my stomach just went meow.
Yes.
It sounded like there was a video game inside me.
Meow.
My stomach meowed. Okay.
So then, even your stomach is cute, honey.
Oh, thank you.
So then I, once I had the thought to do it, the way I am is like, if something occurs to me that I want to do, I become sort of, like a little bit obsessive about it until I finished it.
It's sort of like if something occurs to me that I want you to do, I become obsessive about it until you finish it.
We're similar in that way. That's why we get along, honey. I just became very obsessed about making this book, and that was about 3 months before your birthday, and I had no idea how much time it would take or how hard it would be. And so I researched bookbinding, and I didn't want to do just a craftsy job of it. I wanted to do like a real book. I wanted it to look like a real hardback book that you could buy. So I went and found these old books from like the 19th century that were all about bookbinding. And then I went out and bought the supplies and.
You even bought a horse, which I thought was taking it really far.
Yeah, exactly. I bought a donkey. I did a whole, and then, you know, I went on Etsy. I bought like a book press that was, it was sort of just a handmade thing, but it was cause you need to, whatever. What I didn't count on, and then I thought, okay, in order to make this the way I think it should be, each essay should have a illustration to accompany it, because I always loved when you're reading a book of essays, especially humorous essays, when the illustration kind of complements it in a fun way. Cause it was like, oh, okay. You might see an illustration and go, and then the title, and you're like, what does that have to do with the thing? And so the illustration is like a little joke. But the problem is I had to do all of this at work, because I can't do it at home, otherwise you would know. And so it was a huge thing that I undertook, because I had to illustrate. I had to not only illustrate 52 stories and come up with what I would illustrate and then draw it, which is not my strong suit. But then I also
What's not your strong suit?
Illustrating. Then I also had to figure out how to bind it and make it, and I had to do all of this like an hour a day after work. So it took me 3 months and was very, but anyway, that's what happened. And then, but I did it, and I gave it to you on your birthday.
Back in those, you know, I'm thinking, how did I not realize you were coming home from work late? Was I working, I was working evenings back then, right?
Yeah, you
so
were.
So you would come home and then I would get home? I can't remember that long ago.
Yeah, but I also work late generally anyway. So, you know, it wasn't like I was coming home at 10,
mm-hmm.
you know. I was just coming home a little bit later than normal. And you were just used to it because it was happening over the course of a few months. Yeah. So that was the process. But it was fun. I mean, it's too bad that we can't put out the book as I did it, because I even had, because I did it the way like an old fashioned book would be made. So mm-hmm. it's hardback, and then there's like little, I forget what they're called, like the little threads on the ends of the spine that have the colored threads.
Oh, and, spine doodads?
Yeah. And then I got a bookmark
mm-hmm, that with has ducks
little
on duck, it.
Like little ducklings on it. So
it's
that
very
you can,
cute.
So anyway, yeah. But it was a lot of fun. It's like bookbinding is actually, you know, cause it's, you print out the signatures and then you actually hand thread them. And then, you know,
I don't even know what signatures are.
Those are like 16 pages at a time and you fold them and that's what books are made out of. And they're like groups of 16 pages all threaded together and then glued on the spine.
And can you talk for a second about this? So in the actual book that they will get, mm-hmm. There's a little picture of the book that you made and sort of an explanation of it. Mm-hmm. So they will be able to see the picture. Could you talk for a second about choosing that picture as the cover? It's me kind of smirking. It's not the most attractive picture of me.
Oh, well, yeah, the cover actually, I wanted to get, yeah, I mean, that was the toughest part. I chose a picture I liked of you.
But it's a fun one.
That I thought was funny because you look very smug. And that
Thank
amuses
you.
Me. And then it also has Oliver in it. So, I don't know. I enjoy the picture and it's like you're very pleased with yourself. Like, read my essays. I'm pretty smart.
How was it figuring out what illustrations to do for each essay? And also, how was it now I'm asking you to remember something from a long time ago, but I don't know. Were you regularly reading my column at the time?
Sometimes I was, but you know, yeah, not.
You're not my biggest fan.
No, it's just, I don't know. I'm not a big reader of yours.
That's not true.
No, I would read some. I don't think I got to every one of them. But I ended up reading them all because, yeah, some of the ideas for illustrations were super easy because, you know, there was an obvious, thing to draw from the essay.
Like if it was Oliver.
Yeah, like the Oliver stuff or whatever. And then some of them were, I had to really come up with something because you're, generally not a visual person.
Mm-hmm.
You don't create a lot of visuals in your writing. You do a lot of wordplay. And so oftentimes the illustration would have to be conceptual. Those ended up being the most
Maybe
fun.
I'm just I think I create high concept visuals.
I'm not saying you don't do visuals at all.
Like
I'm
my
just
imaginary
saying, like,
cape friends. Do you remember which one that was?
Yeah, yeah.
That's all visual.
I think most of the fun is your wordplay with that though,
right.
And the names and stuff. So
yeah,
I think
maybe.
That, you know, if like you're talking about people's names, what's the visual on that, you know? So with that one, you know, I think I had a computer screen with a Facebook page
yeah.
for Cape Cod. Like that was, I had to really think about how I could visualize the idea of you fantasizing about that.
Right.
You know, because there isn't a visual that goes with that. So, yeah, or the one with like Montenegro.
Which I didn't even realize, until I was doing the audiobook. I had never looked at that illustration closely enough to realize there's a city called Huge Beak.
Huge Beak, Schnauzelberg.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was fun. It was fun. It's just, I wish I'd had more time because it was like a week before your birthday and I'm like, I still have 12 of these to do, you know, so.
Right. And when I told you that creators wanted to turn it into a book, which was so exciting, you were like, ah, but the illustrations aren't ready.
Some of them, we ended up going with, I didn't really do anything. They're pretty much as they were.
Yeah.
I think I may have straightened some lines on some of them because it's like, by the end, I was like really rushing to get some of these done. And some of them were more polished than, I mean, I wouldn't even say any of them are really polished, but it's like, I don't know.
They're pretty good. I know that you.
They're all right.
All right.
Hopefully they're fun though. Hopefully like it's
they're much better than Daniel is giving himself credit for.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully it adds a little bit to the story. And
I think it adds a lot.
Bit. Yeah. So, I don't know. It was.
And also, I think it adds a lot because some of them were based off of actual photographs.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I used a lot of photo references, especially for Oliver, just because, you know, I wanted to get it right.
The one that to me looks the most like Oliver was, I forget which essay it is, but it's, I'm not going to use specific names, but it's a friend of yours holding her baby and yeah. Oliver. Do you
that
remember?
That was Celia. That was, yeah.
Okay, you can use names.
Oh.
I think it's okay.
Yeah, I don't care. Yes, and that was a photo, yeah. But I didn't...
What I told them, because when I did the audiobook, I went through, you know, I would explain what each illustration is because yeah. not everyone has the book in front of them. Probably no one. I mean, I would hope you would have it on your bookshelf, but probably no one is reading it as they're hearing it. Anyway, I would explain the illustration and then sort of give some commentary. And that one, I said, looked the most like Oliver of all of them, even though they all look like Oliver, but that really captured his Oliver-ness.
Yeah. Yeah, because he has his that was a cute picture. I liked that one of him. I liked the Evel Knievel one. That
yeah.
was fun. Yeah, I liked drawing Oliver. I don't know, you know, we should talk about how I handcrafted the audiobook too for this.
Oh, okay. And now, yeah. I just found the photo. It's not your friend and her baby and Oliver. It's just the baby and Oliver.
Just the baby and Oliver.
Yeah. It's very Oliver-y.
We're looking at it now. Yes.
Oh. It's kind of hard for me doing the audiobook, reading all this stuff about Oliver. Hard, but also happy because I was reminded of a lot of things about him.
Yeah, that was right before he died.
Yeah.
That you were writing all of these. Yeah, I mean, if you had continued to write your essays, like if you had
well,
continued
I did. The column did.
There are more after this, but not
yes.
a lot.
Right. The column did continue after the first year, and they were less funny.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Well, I actually was thinking when I did it, like I would do one of these each year if you were going to continue to do the column. But, yeah, life got really
hard
for the next year. I think it would have been tough for you to keep a light,
spirit
with writing these for sure.
Let's talk a bit about the representation of you in the book.
Okay.
Guy who wears skinny jeans that leak all over my couch. guy who previously dated a buxom lady and did not handle that diplomatically with me, your crazy girlfriend. guy who got in a fender bender Rooney on our way to Santa Barbara. These are just some examples of your depiction.
So are you asking me what I think about how I'm depicted?
Yes. I feel like I gave a pretty ungenerous version just now.
I think that the thing that comes through in this book is that you are the crazy one. So I don't really need to defend myself. I mean, it's obvious to the reader that I'm usually in the right. I don't know. You know, it's all pretty mellow stuff. I don't feel like. You know, like the stuff about my ex or whatever is, I think that's pretty common you know, with not knowing how to handle talking about stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's just one of those things in life. Like, I don't know, you can't, especially guys. I mean, it's hard to do the math when talking about something of how it's going to be heard and be completely honest. And, you know, it can be very confusing.
Let's talk for a moment about the time that I test drove a car into another car.
Yes.
Do you remember that well?
Of course. Yeah, that was funny.
Funny is not the word I would use.
So funny, I thought it was pretty funny.
Many, in retrospect, perhaps. But as I mentioned in the column, remind me again why you didn't say anything like, hey, you're about to hit a car. It sounds like I'm trying to blame other people. And I am.
Well, it happened pretty quickly.
It did.
And
that other car snuck up onto us and attacked us.
I don't know that I didn't make a noise or something. I think, I mean, it might have been, oh, no, like something. I probably said something to that effect. I don't know that I was fully, you know, monitoring the situation either. I don't know that I was, like, riveted to the rear view. I think it had one of those, and that's, I think, the illustration is of the rear view camera, which is not something I have ever had. And so that whole thing is, I think I might have been, you can see, like, there's like a grid with those things where it's like.
Yeah, I was confused too because I didn't have a backup camera either.
Right.
So I was like, this
like,
is indecipherable to me. I don't know what this means.
Yeah, like if you've never used it, it's like, wait, is that 2 feet or 1 foot? Mm-hmm. Is that an inch? I don't know. And, so I think I was probably like, boy, that looks really close, but maybe it's not so, you know, oh, okay, it was.
Do you remember me going, did I just hit a car?
Yeah. It was funny because the guy who is taking us on the test drive was like, oh, no, it's okay. And you can tell he like probably wasn't really that okay, but,
yeah, he was really trying to reassure us it was fine. And then could you just come in to the dealership and talk? And I was like, we've got to go.
Yeah. He didn't take your ID. So we're like, well, you know, we can just bail. That was your idea. Like,
yes.
Let's bail. So we just took off.
I don't feel good about it, but.
You know what?
Fine.
They have their own folks that do the body work and it's fine.
Right.
It's his fault too, because he had you back into a very narrow parking spot in a car that you weren't familiar with. I mean, he should have known better than that.
I guess. I think so.
I think so.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah. Well,
the listeners and
I hope everybody enjoys
the readers
book.
And me.
I didn't think that it would actually get published, so it's kind of cool for me that it is.
I'm flipping through as we're talking. I enjoyed this photo that goes along with this photo, this illustration that goes along with no chips, no nuts.
Yeah.
And it's a chip and a nut holding hands.
Yeah.
They're so cute.
Mm-hmm. That's a cartoon that I'm selling to Cartoon Network. a Pringle and a, oh no, I guess that was a corn chip and a cashew.
Daniel, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Not really. I'm glad this is coming out. I'm hoping, like I said, I hope everybody enjoys it. I think that it would be nice if you wrote another one.
The publisher feels that way too.
So get to work.
Are you going to illustrate it?
You know, you have to talk to my agent.
Oh no, you've gone big time. Okay. Thank you so much. All right. Bye everyone.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.